Welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with the movers and shakers, those film and TV and streaming makers, the producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, film editors, sound editors, mixers and designers, costume designers, production designers, composers, VFX gurus, and everyone else who is part of the teams who make movie and TV magic. First, a big congratulations to Harrison Ford, who received the SAG-AFTRA Lifetime Achievement Award last night. And talk about an emotional acceptance speech. I don't think I've ever seen or heard Harrison that emotional. Just wow. Wow. I think he touched everybody in the room and everybody watching. But you knew I had to bring this up at some point. How many of you caught the season premiere of Marshals on CBS? You all know my love of Yellowstone and the majority of Taylor Sheridan works. I'm not too thrilled with some of what he's doing lately, but Marshals, I am in. This is the first spinoff from Yellowstone, and this one follows the life of Casey Dutton after the death of John Dutton and the sale of the Yellowstone Ranch to the Broken Rock Tribe. Luke Grimes is back as Casey, and joining him are returning Yellowstone faves Brecken Merrill as Casey's son Tate, and boy, is Brecken growing up. He was just a little guy when he started on Yellowstone. Wow. Mo Brings Plenty is back as Mo, and Mo is the right-hand enforcer guide to Chairman Thomas Rainwater, head of the Broken Rock Tribe, who is once again played, still yet and always, by Gil Birmingham. The show is absolutely fantastic. I was glued. And one of my favorite elements is the scoring by Brian Tyler and Brett and Vivian, our dynamic composing duo from Yellowstone. They bring through some of the same musical motifs that are identifiable. Casey, if you watched all five seasons of Yellowstone, the characters all had their own motifs, musical motifs. Brian and Bretton bring those back here. We hear Casey's motif. We hear Tate's a motif for Broken Rock. So it's wonderful to have that thread. Plus, they're filming in the same area and where we last left Casey when Yellowstone ended. It's action-packed. The story is solid. The new characters that come in are wonderful. I like where they're taking Casey and Tate. In terms of character, I'm like hanging on tenterhooks, waiting to see what happens in episode 2 to Chairman Rainwater. Something untoward happened in the first episode, but we'll see what the outcome is. But questions that have been raised since Yellowstone ended and Marshals begins, all of that is getting answered for us. So, Yellowstone fans are going to be happy. New fans to Marshals are going to be happy. I can't wait to see what the rest of the season brings us. And if you haven't seen it, check it out. It airs Sundays at 8 p.m. on CBS. Yes, on broadcast television. And hopefully by the time the first season of Marshals ends, we might be ready for the Rip and Beth spinoff. Which I think that's the one everybody is really waiting to see what happens. But as for Behind the Lens today, today's show is jam-packed. I promised you it would be. It is. No short shrift under an hour this week, folks. I've got two fantastic interviews and two equally fantastic films for you. The filmmakers are enthusiastic, energetic, and excited about filmmaking. You'll be hearing from writer-director Sin K. Lee in the second half of the show talking about his new film, Last Ride. But first up is my exclusive interview with writer-director Nastasya Popov, going in-depth about her narrative feature directorial film debut, Idiotka. Now, I love the whole premise here. In this sharp, irreverent comedy, a disgraced fashion designer with a dangerously low credit score named Margarita. Margarita enters a reality show a la Project Runway, only without the budget of Project Runway and without the talent of Christian Siriano. but there's a six-figure cash prize attached to the show, and it would save her babushka, her grandmother's West Hollywood apartment, where the entire family lives, multi-generational, under one roof. But as the competition intensifies, the show's producer, Nicole, pushes Margarita to spin her family's struggles into spectacle, which forces Margarita to decide whether to play along or take control of her own narrative, one unhinged look at a time. It's written and directed by Nastasya Popov, and it stars Anna Baryshnikov, Camila Mendez, Julia Fox, Benito Skinner, Saweetie, Owen Thiel, Galina Jovovich, Mark Ivanir, Nurses Stamos, and Ilya Volok. Most of them are actors we have not seen or heard from, but they are definitely all. Everybody delivers strong performances. Some are hilarious. It's a solid cast for this film. Now, in this conversation, as Nastasya goes deep into the making of Idiotka, you're going to find out, you're going to learn, this is a film inspired by her own semi-autobiographical experiences, and it blends themes of immigration, housing issues, intergenerational family dynamics, and puts all of that, which is enough of a comedy in its own respect, or drama, but then melds that with a reality TV satire. Now, we spend a lot of time talking about the production elements, particularly the film's cinematography and Nastasya's work with cinematographer Kristen Correll in developing the film's visual grammar, which is, it's complex because, number one, color comes into play, but you've got three primary settings, all of which demand something different, not the least of which is the filming of this reality TV show done, filmed as a TV show and not a movie. So it's really interesting. And Kristen and Nastasya, the visual grammar is really well done. Tied in with that is also the production design by Francesca Palumbo, and costuming by Sophie Kay and Nastasya Simkowitz. And I gotta tell you, it's hard to make ugly costumes. And it was required that Sophie had to make some ugly costumes in this film. But she also makes some really cool ones. For all of you, you know, Project Runway and any other sewing competition films we've seen over the years, if you like fashion, it's worth seeing just for that, to understand and appreciate the metaphor that goes into each of the costumes that we see and how that represents Margarita and her family and her culture. But these three elements, they all work synergistically in terms of the color, the lighting, and balancing cinematic style with reality TV. Editing is also crucial, and we dive into the work of Taylor Joy Mason and Rob Paglia. Now, for my money, it was a smart move to bring Rob on board, given his television editing experience and the reality TV aspect of Idiotka, because even the reality TV aspect, it's cut differently than the rest of the film. So there's a lot of thought that went into this film. Now, Nastasya, she's also quite candid, talking about the creativity required given the budgetary constraints, as well as the collaborative effort of her team. And she even, near the end of the interview, gets in a little bit about distribution and working with Utopia as her distributor, and their willingness to listen to her and go along with her plan for the film's rollout. So that's something that all of you filmmakers, especially first-time filmmakers, indie filmmakers, second-time indie filmmakers, you really want to listen to this, because sometimes you think that you can have no say. Well, you can have a say in your film's marketing and rollout. So hear what, you know, you want to take a listen at what Nastasia has to say. And the whole film, it's filled with heart. It's a film dedicated to her grandmother. And you're going to see and feel that as you watch the film. So take a listen as Nastasia Popov talks about Idioka. Hey, Nastasia.
Hi. How are you?
I am so excited to be talking with you about Idioka. Oh my God. Number one, I love the trailer, and I immediately emailed the girls and said, I have to see this film. Then I watched this film. I laughed my ass off. This is so much fun. There's so much heart. What you have created visually in terms of your use of color, Sophie K's costumes, Francesca's production design, and Kristen's cinematography, the lighting and lensing, is visually exciting, keeps us invested so that we can really appreciate the heart that comes out within this family and within Margarita's dreams. Just so well done, Nastasia. So well done.
Wow, thank you so much. That truly means the world. And as you know, these films take forever to see the light of day. So, you know, just the appreciation for the craft that went into it it means so much.
And one of the great things about indie film that I love about it in particular is the fact that indie film, especially like Idioka, we're talking low budget, sometimes no budget, micro budget. So it really forces your directorial vision and forces you to be creative. And I have seen time and time again, and your film is one of them, where you do so much with little. I can see the creativity and your vision coming out in every frame. So kudos to you on that and on having a vision and being able to bring it forth so it's recognizable. That is something I really appreciate that you've done.
Thank you so much.
Now, where did the idea, because you got a lot of things happening here as your core themes. You've got, we're talking about, and it's timelier than ever, immigration, housing issues, unaffordability. Of course, I do have to say that Vlad is, he's not a bad landlord to let them go 5 months without paying their rent. So you've got the blend of the Russian, Jewish, American cultural blends happening. You bring in reality TV. And definitely you're paying great homage to Project Runway. And at the heart of it, you've got the intergenerational family all under one roof, which that in and of itself, you don't need anything else. You just have multiple generations of a family under one roof, and you have chaotic humor. So how did you, when you sat down to write this, were you at breakfast one morning looking at a box of cereal or eating something because they don't have pictures and writing on cereal boxes anymore? Did you just get this great idea for this film? How did this idea arise?
Wow. You really hit all the buckets, and I know there are a lot of them, so thank you. So I think it really started off when I moved. You know, I would say the movie is semi-autobiographical. Some stuff is heightened and invented, and some is really rooted in my own experience. But I was inspired by the moving back into this intergenerational household with my Russian Jewish grandmother and my parents and my sister and my boyfriend. And it was after having lived away from home for, you know, 7 years. You know, I went to college and then I lived in New York. And then after the pandemic, I moved back home because I really was committed to making this movie. And that chaotic, claustrophobic energy was, you know, so much deal with, and such a shock after being an independent adult that I truly just like needed to, one, it was really funny, but two, I needed a way to cope.
Yeah.
So I think that, that's where the idea started off with, as you said, you know, the heart of the story is this intergenerational family story and all the humor that comes out of that. And then I think, you know, as I was working with my best friend and longtime collaborator, Tess Cohen, who produced and, you know, co-wrote the story for the film, I think we always, our goal was to make sure that it wasn't like a small indie, you know, that it didn't feel small. And I think that in that way, we were just thinking of ways to expand the world beyond just it being a family story. And my sister is a fashion designer. So at that point, this reality TV engine for the story really clicked. And being from LA and growing up around all these larger than life characters that Hollywood attracts, I think it just, you know, expanded our casting possibilities by so much to add in this, like, you know, look at this flailing and floundering designer who doesn't even know who she is yet. And then she's placed on this stage where she's kind of asked to regurgitate every detail about her life and how much, you know. And then I think we just knew that, and then after that, I, you know, so just all this to say that there were many different versions of the script that got it to the place where it is this combination of immigrant family story and like fashion satire.
It is brilliant the way you have interwoven everything, Nastasia. I am so impressed, and thank God you have so many people in your family you can draw from. You know, we all can condemn our families at times, but when you get into a situation like this, it's like, ooh, I can use that, and I can use that. And so it works out really well for you in the creative process.
Yes, totally. And I think, yeah. I think, yeah.
It's just fabulous. Now, were you coming up with storyboards or shot lists? Were you envisioning the visuals as you and Tess were writing this?
I think just, you know, yes, by writing so many versions of the scripts, I just knew it backwards and forwards. I think I was, one of the ways that we worked within the budgetary constraints is the whole time I was, you know, pitching to investors, I was like, we can shoot this film in my actual grandmother's apartment. So mm-hmm. I think it was, you know, I knew the space so well, and I had saved so many of her things so that we could save on production design. And yeah, I think by the time we got on set, I was completely, you know, the vision was completely in my mind. And that's, I think, one of the beauties of writing from personal experience is that it, you know, I mean, I think a director is hopefully very in tune with their intuition, because it's probably one of the most important parts of the job. But it did, by the time we got to the shooting days, it did feel very intuitive.
Well, I have to say, you remind me, I was talking with Rennie Harlan the other day, and Rennie said something that is so important for when you're a director and you develop a vision, and you can tell somebody, you can tell your DP, you can tell a costumer, but you have it so ingrained in your own head based on the context of your life. And he said, sometimes it's hard to convey that, but it's so important that your visions are formulated by the taken in context of the life you have lived, not that anybody else has. And I think it's very clear, especially when looking at the house and all the little knickknacks and things in there. There are some beautiful little pieces in there that I know those were family pieces for you. They weren't set dress.
Absolutely. But I do have to give a special shout out to our production designer, who, for practical reasons, we moved the whole set, you know, we were supposed to shoot on the second floor, which was where my grandmother's apartment was, but she essentially recreated it on the first floor. And she just, you know, I just think that what, you know, what masters of their craft do is take my vision and all the specific objects that I imagined and then take it to another level.
Well, and I have to say, Francesca's production design is fantastic. Number one, I love the apartment. I love everything that's done there. I love the mess of Margarita's, well, the whole house. I love the mess. It's lived in. It is life personified. And it's the kind of place you never know what you're going to see when you lift something up. But it speaks directly to Margarita. That is her. And that comes through in her character. It comes through in her, how she reacts to things, how she approaches things, how she designs everything. It's shoot from the hip to get from point A to point B and use whatever tools you have at your disposal. And that just screams so loudly. I love how Francesca's work really feeds into that for Margarita, because without all of that, Margarita would not be who she is, and we wouldn't have the humor that we have. But while we're talking about Francesca, this is really a three-pronged, this is a triumvirate you've got happening here, Anastasia. You've got Francesca's work on production design, you have Sophie Kay's fantastic costume work, and it must have been hard for her to try and actually intentionally make some ugly stuff. But then you bring in Kristen as your DP, lighting and lensing this and taking us from the claustrophobic family home, grandma's bedroom, Margarita's space, into the production offices for the reality show, into the runway and working studio of the reality show. You've got different lighting techniques happening, your camera angles, you even divvy them up, and really, you and Kristen develop visual grammar that is celebrated with extreme close-ups of certain things. So talk to me about bringing those three elements together to create your visual design.
Wow. So we touched on Francesca, and so then So we actually had two costume designers. One was Sophie Kay and one was Natasha Simkowitz. And they worked together. They were co-costume designers who worked together to, exactly as you said, sometimes they had to make stuff look purposefully ugly because it was a reality TV show where there's some contestants who are less talented, and supposedly they made the piece in 3 hours during a challenge. So I think they really just sourced, you know, a ton of vintage and were extremely resourceful throughout the process. And also just like, you know, I wrote Margarita to be a character who wears gloves all the time, but then they took that to another level. They had her wearing, you know, sweatshirts backwards and aprons as belts and, you know, things that a real fashion student would do and experiment with. And I just think they took her eccentricity and ran with it in a way that I never could have imagined. And just a shout out that all three of the crew heads were women, and that wasn't even really a purposeful choice by me. It was just, you know, lucky that all four of them, because two shared the title, but it was just so amazing to communicate, you know, I just think they brought also that like feminine touch to the whole film, which you're sort of experiencing. And it was just so easy to work with all of them. And then with Kristen, I mean, she has truly become a dear, dear friend. And she just, I think what I loved most is she had as much of an appreciation for reality TV and how that's shot as she did for, you know, the more quiet, you know, truly cinematic moments. And so she even used two different lens types. The lens in the grounded moments had like more texture and history to it, whereas you can feel the cleanness of the lens in the reality show elements. And she, you know, just actually used movements that they would use in a reality show, like the jib, and, you know, I don't know all the words for it, but she just took it really seriously and knew that it was an opportunity to make the audience really feel the be on that ride with Margarita. And I'm just, like, infinitely impressed by what she achieved.
Yeah, I mean, I'm extremely impressed with what Kristen achieved. And definitely the visual tonal bandwidth. You feel the differential between the standard cinematic look of the family, the house, casual moments, you know, on the street or something, contrasting that with the reality TV show and what goes on with that. You feel and you see the difference there. And that's a tricky thing to master. And a big part of that also, credit has to go to your editors on that. I mean, you've got Rob Paglia as one of your editors. And TV, episodic TV, that is his bailiwick right there. And that's what you needed for this. But then you also have Taylor Joy Mason in there. But you've got here, even in your editing, it's the meeting of two worlds, Nastasha. So we have the reality TV episodic look and feel, but then we also have the at home before we suddenly get surprised with a camera crew at the front door wanting to come inside when everybody's like in the shower and bathrobes. Segueing from the visuals into the editing process, what led you to go with Taylor and with Rob to edit this?
Yeah, I think, you know, with Taylor, she has such a firm grasp of narrative and emotion. And and then with Rob, his comedic, you know, his ability to just mine moments for comedy, you know, as he does so expertly in Hack, is, you know, what he, when I saw his like edits of some of the reality show stuff, I was just stunned because he, you know, just found moments that I didn't even know existed. And I think that you're exactly right that this movie does toggle two tones. And it was true. It was a challenge, you know, in the editing room to make sure that we were, you know, making the audience needs to never feel jarred by like the switch into like high satire from this more like grounded family story. So yes, I really am just, I think that both of them added their touch. And I should also give a shout out to Rudy Mancuso, who is the fiance of Camila Mendez, one of our producers, and he edited the trailer and he also helped edit the opening sequence. He is just like, and I think that sequence really required a lot of expertise in sound. So he just like helped out as a consulting editor to give that, you know, make sure that the film opens in a textured way that it deserves.
So it's thanks to him that I fell in love and demanded to see this film to begin with, because it was the trailer that just hooked me right away. So
exactly.
That's due to Rudy. But an important word that you just said, texture, because there's visual texture here, there's emotional texture, and of course you've got the texture of fashion and fabric. So you've got metaphor upon metaphor happening here, but you follow it all through on every level. And that could not have been an easy tightrope to walk for you.
No.
Long pause.
It's been a long journey, and I think that luckily I was really passionate about telling this story, and it required sacrifice and patience and you know, tenacity, I guess. And I think that luckily I just you know, had a lot of filmmakers to admire and be like, they did it somehow. So at this point, and luckily, you know, all our investors and my collaborators, they really took a chance on me as a first-time director. And I feel really proud of all the work that, you know, finally is getting to see the light of day after so many years.
You were at South By last year. So you've already got distribution. The film it's out for people to see. You're ahead of the game. There are some guys I know that have been at South By and other festivals going back to 2024, 23. They still don't have distribution deals, of course.
Yes, we're really lucky that Utopia, I think, you know, that Utopia understood and loved the film and just, you know, they've been such amazing partners to work with in the sense that, like, they really have listened to my creative vision for how it should be rolled out and marketed. And, they've just been amazing. And, of course, I've admired the films that they've launched and the careers they've launched in the past. So I know I'm so lucky in this landscape to have distribution.
Now, I've got to ask you about, because after you have all of this, all these themes running through and everything being serviced so perfectly and eye-popping color, the color palette is fantastic with the colors that are brought in, be it in fashion, in the apartment, out in that beautiful little patio garden that some people were not supposed to be napping on during the night. It's incredible. And then we get to the final runway show, because of course there has to be a final runway show as to who is in and who is out. That whole entire sequence is so beautifully done, Nastasia. What were your thoughts in coming up with the design of that runway sequence? Because the lighting changes, everything changes, and it's stunning.
Thank you so much. I think, I think that it needed to be a culmination of the film, and a lot of people warned me that, you know, don't write a scene that the whole film hinges on because it's hard to pull off, but I really, you know, believe that if we leaned into the high-low of it, you know, like the kitschy Russian restaurant and these celebrity judges being like, oh, the food smells here, and then, and then kind of just them leaning into the joy, and that's really the theme of the whole film, that, like, if you trust the process and you let yourself get into the flow state of your art, you know, other people will notice, and it's most important what you think of yourself. And I think that really the sentiment of that final sequence is watching Margarita finally be comfortable in her own skin and embrace her family. And I don't want to give too much away,
The dress is
obviously thematic, and it's about, you know, I always kind of discuss that this movie is about wearing your shame. So the dress was supposed to be the personification of that. And wow. I should give a shout out to Little Miss Sunshine, which of course was a major inspiration. And in that scene, I feel like just watching watching the family all together, it just brings you such unadulterated joy.
Yes.
I even remember in the editing room with Taylor, we were just like, you know, it's just like fun to watch.
It is. And it's not just wearing, you know, wear your shame. It's also very much the flip side, wear your pride. Because out of some of what people may think is shame, you can get your greatest pride for overcoming it and for going above and beyond. So just wonderful, wonderful. And of course, a caveat for everybody, they have to watch the credits. They have to watch the credits because you give us a wonderful end credit montage, shall we say. It's very entertaining. It is heartfelt. It's beautiful. And that's all I'm going to say about that part of the film, because I want them to see it. And it was very smart of you to make sure you had something happening for an epilogue and credit thing to make people want to stay. Very astute of you to do that.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll thank my producers there for making sure that there was, you know, it's always worth shooting making sure there are no loose ends when you're shooting. And, you know, if you don't use it, you don't use it. But I think, yeah, I was lucky to have experienced people in my corner saying, you know, just get that just in case.
Yep. So now, at the end of the day, you have survived. You have served up a great film, and you have slayed it. Yes, I'm playing on you in reverse. Your first feature directorial. What did you learn about yourself as a director, as a filmmaker, in making Idioka that you can now take forward into future projects, of which there better be many? I'll just say that now.
You are correct. There will be many. what did I learn?
Because it's a big jump. It's a big jump to go from shorts or a music vid or something into a feature.
Yeah, I think I learned to trust myself. I think at every point, people wanted to doubt me, and I didn't let them. I didn't take no for an answer, and I just was convinced that I could do this. And I think that with, yeah, being a director, you really have to learn on the job. So you have to create these opportunities where after years of writing a script, you finally get to those 19 days on set. So I think, just trust the process and trust your instincts and, truly don't give up. And I think I've now become a bit calmer in, you know, when something's going wrong, just having the faith that it always figures itself out. You know, every cast member fell into place, even if, you know, a week before shooting, we were still casting. And I think that's part of filmmaking. You just have to know that everything, just like in life, happens for a reason.
So what would your grandmother say about this film?
I think she'd be really proud. I'm sure she'd have some snarky remarks. But I think she'd be extremely, extremely proud. And as you know, I really made it in her honor. And it does still bring me a lot of comfort to have, you know, immortalized her presence in that way. And I think that's really what kept me going for so long. So I do feel like she was my guardian angel throughout this process, making me emotional.
Well, I got news for you. I got emotional watching it when you dedicated it to your grandmother. But I guarantee you, your grandmother would be really happy with what you achieved.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I'm really lucky to have such an amazing family that supports me and, you know, sacrificed so much so that I could truly be living the dream that it is to get to, you know, be an artist professionally at times. So I think it really is made for my family. So please see it in theaters.
Now, have you moved out of the family house, though?
Yes.
Hallelujah. All right.
Hallelujah.
Big
Hallelujah.
Girl, all grown up, out on her own. All right, way to go.
Finally.
Nastasia, I can't thank you enough for taking time to talk with me about Idioka. This film, it's so much fun. It has so much heart. I really love this film. And I can't wait to see what you make next.
Thank you so much. This was an incredible conversation, and I really love your passion for the movie, and I can feel it. So these kinds of chats mean so much to finally, the film is finding its audience. So thank you so much for helping with that and for the conversation.
Now if the producers was get would just get on the horn with the producers of Project Runway, maybe get an endorsement from Christian Siriano.
I love that. I love that idea. I'll put it on my to-do list.
Thank you so much, Nastasia, and you go have a great rest of your day, week, whatever. And that was writer-director Nastasia Popov talking about Idioka, which is currently in theaters. It just opened on Friday, so check it out. Check your local listings and find out where it is and go see it. Well worth the price of admission. And make sure when you see it, stay through the credits, as there are some real treats for you with a visual epilogue that I think you're going to love. Now we go from the fun of comedy to fear, tension, and friendship. That we find in the survival thriller Last Ride from writer-director Sin K. Lee. Now, Last Ride is set in the winter of 1982, where three 12-year-old American boys find themselves stranded in a cable car with a dead body suspended midair in the mountains of Norway during a rare celestial planetary alignment. Ironically, we just had a six-planet planetary alignment on Saturday. Written and directed by Sin K. Lee, and yes, he is Spike's brother. Last Ride stars Roman Griffin Davis, who you know best from Jojo Rabbit, The Long Walk, and most recently, Greenland 2: Migration. Felix Jamieson, who you may remember from Game of Thrones, Charlie Price from The Great, and capping them all, our three friends who are stuck in the cable car. Capping that off with Christopher Hivju, who plays Øyvind, the cable car operator. And he is wonderful, I gotta say. As if these three boys together are not wonderful enough, you toss him in the mix, it's great. Now, I love Sinké. He is so enthusiastic, he is so passionate. But also so filled with heart when you speak with him that it's no surprise that you see and feel all of that on screen. In this exclusive conversation, Sin K breaks down the production for us with really incredible insight into much of the movie magic he brought into the mix, highlighting the visual and emotional depth achieved within a cable car setting. It's one location in a cable car, and it's in a cable car. This is not a built three-wall thing and you've got one wall open. No, it's a cable car. He emphasizes the importance of capturing the authenticity of 12-year-old boys' behavior, which impacted the visual grammar, but it also is very key to some of what they experience while they are stranded during the night, during the day and night. In that cable car, because what do you think 12-year-old boys are going to do when they're up in a cable car alone and no adults watching them? Yep. Think back to when you were 12 and just think about the things you would have done. So those things, which Sinké incorporated into the script, it really impacts the innovative visual grammar that he brings us, including using multiple cameras and practical effects. Like he licensed real footage of the Northern Lights. He didn't want CGI, he didn't want a matte painting. He licensed video that someone had taken who lives in, I think it's Finland, that they shot of the Northern Lights. And then there's an exquisite sequence that gets into the planetary alignment that's occurring while the boys are up in the cable car. And I initially thought that this was CGI, that it was something. And you're going to hear him talk about how he found an artist who paints on water, to achieve the visuals that we see in this entire sequence. That really gives it a very organic feel. Everything about this film, he really leans into Mother Nature with the sound, with the wind, with the snow, with birds going nutso up there, undoubtedly due to the planetary alignment, because weird things happen during the alignments with nature. It's just everything is so organic. And the effects of, you know, the boys, snow gets in the cable car because they keep opening the doors. Things like that. Really outstanding work. But the painting on water sequence, it is to die for. To die for, people. If for no other reason, see the movie for that one sequence. But he also shares the challenges of filming in Finland, which stands in beautifully for Norway. The meticulous sound design, my God, it's epic. And the personal inspiration for the film, which he drew from his own lost childhood friendships. And all of that gives way to the film's themes of trauma, friendship, and the impact of how past experiences impact present lives. It's a fascinating conversation. It's the first time I've ever spoken with Sin K, and I sincerely hope it won't be the last, because I just think he's wonderful. So take a listen as Sin K Lee talks about Last Ride. Well, I can't tell you, Sin K, this is so wonderful to get to speak with you about Last Ride. I was so curious about this film because of having just seen Roman in Greenland 2. So I knew that his capabilities with some action and some terror. But this obviously was shot before he did Greenland 2. So I was really curious going in as to what I was going to see from him. And not only him, but then pairing him with Felix and with Charlie. Wow. You cast this so perfectly. And above all, you let these three boys be boys. You didn't try and adult them. You let them act the way 12-year-old boys act. Thinking about zombies and we're going to get cannibalized in this tram car. Weird things that boys think about at that age. And that gives the film so much heart and so much resonance. Just brilliantly done on your part, Sin K.
Well, thank you so much. I'm glad I'm glad that you had the takeaway with that with you. That's so awesome. That's exactly what I tried to put up on screen.
Well, you definitely succeeded. So there you have the heart, but you know, we need something that's going to keep us visually engaged for 90 minutes inside a cable car. That's a tough thing to do, but boy, oh boy, I got to hand it to you and your DP, to John Christian Rosenlund. You keep this so visually engaging, Sin K. You move the kids around the cable car. You have a definite visual grammar here. And blocking pattern, we see them together. Then we see them separating, and their friendship, it's like cracking a little bit, and each one is at a different wall or setting of windows within the car. Then they come back together again. Then we have something happen that is not too cool, and then they separate, and then you've got some great camera angles where one gets moved into the foreground with the other in the background and slightly blurred. Really wonderfully done. And then you give us the exterior, your VFX with the northern lights, the birds freaked me out. I'll tell you, I'm petrified of birds anyway, so that just totally freaked me out. And you break up the color pattern with bright red blood. Just so visually engaging and stimulating. So I'm curious how you and John developed your visual grammar to keep inside that cable car so engaging and alive.
Thank you. I knew at one point, once the film starts in present day, and the 90% of the film is the kids in 1982. I knew once the kids came in the film, we had the camera. This is something Spielberg did on ET. The camera had to be the kids' eye level.
Yep.
So I wanted to do that, and also I knew I wanted to have two cameras going, sometimes three, on the days that the kids had to cry, because I know that's. You know, these are the 11, 12, 13-year-old kids. I don't want them to be crying. So there are days where we're pretty lucky to shoot it pretty much in sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Unheard of, but we're able to do that. So that was fantastic. So there was a lot of storyboarding, my thumbnail stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of made a thing, and there were things that I thought that I could do. They'll usually shoot in the volume with two cameras going at the same time, so the guys at the Brain Bar had to make software that would go, take an hour out. And this, I knew as far as visual effects go, too, I knew that I didn't want to show when the kids explaining the rare grand alignment that happens when the planets. I was like, no, we're not going to. They were pushing, studio was pushing for special effects. Hey, we can do special. I was like, no effing way. We've seen special effects do not. I'm a special effects geek. Special effects do not hold up. I mean, Avatar is great, but the first one 10 years ago doesn't look as good.
Right.
I'm like, I have to live at this film with the rest of my life. So I found this artist, Turkish artist Gareth A, who actually paints on water, which I thought was more artistic and, it's more of a organic kind of feel for it. So that sort of what. They did 2001 similar at the end of the film when he has a big, rip out.
Mm-hmm.
with all this stuff going. So I wanted to incorporate that. And the Northern Lights that we see in the film, those are actually real. I found a guy in Norway who shoots things, Northern Lights in his town at 4K. So I licensed that footage. And the only thing we did with it, we threw some snow in, some windy snow. So that's all real Northern Lights with the cutaway shots where you see the kids looking up.
Wow.
So that was great for us, too, because we shot in a volume, with basically high-definition television screen. So mm-hmm. what we see in the camera, what the kids are looking at, it's all there. So we don't have any post-production. We don't have to go back and do the effect things. We had to get our plates ready beforehand. We had to get, copters out there, drones and shoot our stuff in Norway, bringing all that to Finland. The whole film was shot in Finland. And so we had our plates there. So it was amazing for the kids to react to what's going on outside, with the birds, shooting at cannons, air cannons. And yeah, there was stuff that we had to do. I had this one shot in the film where the kids are scared and they've got each other, they're in a circle with their backs to each other and cameras going around. However, we didn't have a 360 volume stage, a screen. So mm-hmm. I came up with this idea that, keep the cameraman still and keep the kid still. And we're going to turn the cable car around. And so just have the cameraman stand there like he's walking in place, but the ground underneath him is actually moving. But the kid's just moving. It's like being on the carousel almost. So the background, the screen behind him is going to stay the same. It's kind of hard to visualize, so I did that. But, at the end of the take, the whole thing spun back around and whatnot. So, yeah, there's little things that worked for it that we hadn't planned for, but we were able to pull it off.
Absolutely brilliant. That idea of moving the cable car and keeping the kids and the camera stationary, brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
It worked.
Well, and I'm watching it, and I'm thinking, how the heck do they have a 360 camera moving around in the cable car?
Yeah, look at that.
So
yeah, some people think that we actually shot up there. God bless them. Shot in the air,
It looks so authentic and so realistic, Sin K. I mean, it's just wonderful. Now, talk to me more about The alignment. Those are all watercolor drawings?
They are. They're actually,
Or paint with water streaking?
absolutely. It's a big tray, basically, with about 8 inches of water. I mean, shoot down looking at it. But the reaction of this types of paint that this artist has, Gareth, when it actually hits the water, it has an effect. Sometimes it'll explode, sometimes it will shrink in and bring the water into itself. Sometimes it'll expand itself. So yeah, he basically paints on water.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's a reaction of the type of how the temperature of the water and what kind of paint he has and what's in his toolbox and his paint.
That is
Really
ab
going
it's absolutely beautiful. I mean, I've seen artists do that before. Some of them even add like cooking oil, vegetable oil,
Exactly, yeah.
on top of the water with the paint colors. It is beautiful. And it does. It adds such an organic element because everything about this film is very organic. We're at the mercy of Mother Nature. Okay, we did have a little electrical screw up, which is not Mother Nature, but everything that happens to the boys, it's the cold, it's the snow, it's the wind, it's all Mother Nature, the northern light. So I
Yeah.
love how that does. It makes it feel and look organic. Just like, so everything is its own alignment. Besides the planetary alignment, everything is in alignment with this production. You're blowing my mind here, Sinke. I'm telling you, blowing my
That's
mind with the
great.
tricks that you have used to bring this to life.
Yeah. It was a hands-on kind of thing, which I had a great opportunity at the end of the film. We wrapped. I was like, okay, who's a post-production supervisor? And they're like, this is Finland. The director does that. So I had to stay another 4 months. But it was great because we were working with the special effect. I don't want to give stuff away. Special effect house for obviously the avalanche
Right.
is one of the things we had to couldn't really do.
You gotta throw them a little bit of work, Sinke. You know,
Oh yeah.
they need to stay employed.
Absolutely.
So you gotta throw them
Yeah,
a little
very
bit of
true.
work. Now, the one real adult that we get to see the boys interact with, beautiful performance by Christopher, playing
Richard.
Ovind.
Yeah.
And watching them engage in pure, unadulterated joy inside the cable car is just magical. Watching that, and then you kick into overdrive and send us on a ride that we're not going to soon forget. How difficult was it to cast Christopher in that role? Because you need somebody that looks Nordic, that looks scary and foreboding, but really isn't, and he's a kid at heart.
Really is. He was amazing. I wanted him from the get-go. The film takes place in Norway. I had to get a Norwegian actor, and who doesn't love Christopher? He's so amazing. He came in 4 days earlier than we needed him because he wanted to hang out with the kids. He brought his guitar with him, and they would just hang out singing the class song. He was so engaged in his part, you know, and we had to fabricate a replica of his body too for the film. He was
Sure.
very concerned about how, which I love him for this. He's like, I don't think we should do this, or which is like the body. It's like, I don't think we should desecrate the body in this particular way and this, totally cool. Totally cool. I was on board with everything he wanted. I was like, that's so awesome, man. So he was a lot of fun. And the
Wow.
kids freaking love them.
Well, I got to tell
Especially
you,
the
as I was watching them dancing around and singing and having a blast, and that's a wonderful montage that you have there. Very well cut. It is just, it's freeing, it's fun. But I kept thinking, oh my God, the cable car line is going to snap and the car is going to plummet because you're spending time with some really beautiful ECUs of all of them. of their feet on the floor of the cable car jumping up and down. So you're messing with our minds there, Sin K, as to what's going to happen. So you had me convinced the cable car the line was going to snap and they were going to plummet. And then you faked me out.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, that was going to, in an earlier script, cable car was just going to slide down on its own on ice and just smash into the, you know, the cable car station at the bottom of the thing. But we were like, oh my God, what are we doing? We can't, this will be here another month if we try and do that. So we took it, it served the story better to be more gentle with their coming down, coming down from their icebox, so to speak. And that worked really well. And the composers were amazing. This Finnish group composers, Finnish Academy Award for the work they did in the film Sisu. Sisu 1 and 2. And they were great. I said, I don't want any electronics. I want stuff to be acoustic stuff. I don't want any, you know, stuff. So they were great. They played their, you know, acoustic instruments and drums and winds and things like that. Yeah, I tried to make it hands-on, more 1982-ish, you know, stuff like that. There's a big sound in the film that they hear coming from the sky. It's, you know, the ozone being scraped against each other and all these solar flares. And I found that sound on YouTube. A woman in Canada was on her porch, and she's like, well, listen to the sound. Where is it coming from? It sounds like a freight train, you know, mixed with like a beluga whale, like screaming, or angels screaming from the sky. And I licensed that, you know, we had, you know, the Dolby Atmos person come in. You see this Finnish sound designer guy, mixer. And so I believe that this woman recorded the sound because people hear it all over the world different sounds at times. So that I was very lucky to have that sound and be good enough, even though it came over someone's recorded iPhone, we were able to rattle the cages with it, if you see it in a theater at least.
I got to tell you, Sin K, that sound jumped out at me. And it's right there. You've got the 18-minute mark. It's not too long after that 18-minute mark, probably around 21 minutes or so, we get that sound. I even have it in my notes, in all capital letters with exclamation points. That is so incredible, and it really jolts us, and it provides a complete tonal shift in what's happening within the film. The sound design here is wonderfully done for the whole film with the wind, and we hear what the wind is like when the boys are inside the cable car and wind is on the outside, then when they open the doors or they open the hatch on top, because sure, let's climb up on the top of the cable car hanging there in the middle of the mountains, as every 12-year-old will do.
Sure, things on their own, they get up to bad stuff.
That's it. But the sound design and the mix is impeccably done. And really, again, it plays into organics and makes it so immersive. How long were you guys working on the sound mix on this one?
We had a decent amount of time, actually. We shot the entirety of this film in Finland for Norway, but then we did the mixing actually in Los Angeles because one of the best sound mixers, designers, is actually, he lives in Los Angeles, so that was cool. We got the dude in America. And, I got to sit next to him, you know, we had a dog there, and I put earplugs in our dog's ear, meaning Carly, my partner, but yeah, it was fantastic, and our editor was fantastic too, Ika, he was another Finnish amazing guy who was just fantastic, and he brought so much to this, And it was great, you know, when you were able to have an editor on set, you know, outside the stage, she was in another office editing, you know, as we shot, which is amazing.
I love Ika's editing, and I love how you really hone in on extreme close-ups of each of the boys at different points, especially when they go beyond cannibalism and zombies, and they start getting after a really ugly incident that happens that nobody wants to cop to doing. We really start to learn about their fears and their past and what ties them together in their own alignment.
Mm-hmm.
And the editing coming in with the close-ups. I love a lot of the close-ups on Roman, his character of Devin. And especially where his eyelashes, his eyes are frozen shut. And we see that. And that's kudos to makeup and, you know, which is so beautifully done. But it's the editing where we're really getting inside their heads. And profiles of Sid. We rarely see Sid in a frontal. It's primarily to the side. He's always like shame. He's ashamed of something. So it's really interesting to see what you do in editing with their faces to bring out the truth of who each one of them is. Really well done.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I mean, there's a particular shot of Roman that it's amazing. And the sound actually makes that shot. It's a long take on Roman, but he sort of like checks out.
Mm-hmm.
And the sound of the other characters, his friends talking, goes low, and then the music comes up slightly, and then we sort of get into his head, and then his friends bring him out of it. He's like, huh? So yeah, that was thought out, and it worked. We didn't think it was going to work, but it did.
You're using all the tools in the toolbox, Sinkay, and by doing that, and that scene with Roman is a key one, it really lets us get inside and really feel like we are there in the cable car with these boys. And it brings out empathy from us for what they're going through. Trauma. They're all experiencing trauma and obviously have experienced trauma. Of course, the fact that one's mom may be going out with one's dad, okay, that's going to freak them out, and there's no coming back from that.
Exactly.
You know, that's just standard.
Yeah. The dynamics you have as a kid, these ties you have, you know, how this affects your life, and I wrote it thinking of these friends that I grew up with that I don't have the connection with anymore for some reason. Most of my friends I've known since first grade, which is also odd, but it's also odd that I have a couple of friends that we don't know what happened to them. So this is a love letter to them, things I wanted to say to them, and that I didn't get a chance to say.
But now, Sinkay, I love that inspiration, but something tells me you and your friends were not hanging out in Norway or Finland in a cable car.
That's true. We're upstate New York.
That could be close. Like this winter, if it was this winter, it could be close.
It wasn't winter, it was summer. And there was a time, myself and two friends, I don't know what the hell happened to the farmer and his mom. We were stuck in a tree. It got very dark, and we kind of didn't have a way to get down. Anyway, it's a look back at this, you know, lost relationships and how kind of wish we would have kept them. Sorry that, you know, they fell through our hands, so to speak. Me and my friend's hands, that we lost them in some way or another.
So I'm curious, what, inspired by your own experience with your childhood friends, what led you to take this from upstate New York in the summer and craft it into a story in the middle of winter in Norway, up in a cable car at the top of a mountain?
Yeah, well, I don't know if you've ever seen my my Dinner with Andre, that was amazing. It was a 2.5 hour movie.
Yeah.
The guys just sitting at a restaurant table. I was like, well, I'll take on that challenge. You know, and also there's an Alfred Hitchcock film, Lifeboat, also.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also my favorite film, The Thing, which is a total paranoid movie about not trusting anybody in a really, really cold place. And there's also that book, The Body by Stephen King.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, which is a, I knew I was going to write a coming-of-age story, and I knew it was about these three friends I had looking back on our relationship. And I wanted to tie in how that affected me. Not to say that I'm a friggin' drunk because of that, or not, or am. but I wanted to tie it into today and the past and how it affects somebody and how you could pass it on to someone younger than you, possibly a child,
mm-hmm.
and help them out. Let them know what the hell you went through.
And of course, what's going to give you more trauma than being stranded in a cable car on your way up to a mountain in the middle of Norway in the middle of winter?
Yeah. All they had to do was go back to the hotel and watch a Finnish cartoon. No.
Well,
they had to keep pushing it.
You know, as Devin says, it's Sunday. If I were home, I'd be eating pancakes and watching Bugs Bunny.
Exactly.
That's one of the greatest lines in the film, Sinkay, I gotta tell you.
Thank you.
I fell in love with that, and I'm thinking, Sunday? No, it's Saturday morning cartoons.
It was Sunday, pancakes were Sunday for us. We had, in Brooklyn.
Well, that works. Yeah. Well, yeah, Sunday would be like pancake day, but Bugs Bunny would be on a Saturday. But I like how you blended it together.
Yeah. Well, New York might have been Sundays for here in New York.
I grew up in Philly, and I think we had cartoons both days.
Huh. Yeah. Full-on cartoons in the weekend, absolutely.
Sinkay, you have done an amazing job with this film. So I have one last question for you. What did you learn about yourself as a director, as a storyteller, in making Last Ride that you can now take forward into your future films? You tackle so much here on multiple levels, and you bring it all together beautifully. So I'm curious, what did you learn about you as a filmmaker?
I learned on this film that I learned more about sticking. Being flexible is great. I'm always flexible. But there's certain things I thought were going, that I had to stick to, I thought were going to really be that's going to help the film out. The fact that it's in there is going to help the film, and it's more than it would, it not being there, it would hurt the film. So I knew there were certain things. I knew that close-up of Roman looking into the camera with that split diopter.
Uh-huh.
I mean, every day I was like, where's that lens? That's coming up in 2 weeks. Where's that lens? I'm going to the camera department. Let me see that lens. It's not here. I'm like, what are you doing? It's coming up. You know, so certain things you got to freak out about, and, you know, and then, yeah, certain things you have to know you want in the film. So I learned there's certain things that have to, certain spices you got to bring. You got to bring the set, you know, some homemade spices that you can sprinkle and stuff, I think is very good. You can bring to it.
Well, you brought them all, Sinkay, I'm telling you, and I love them. And one thing I do have to say, though, everybody has to watch through the credits. They have to sit through the credits on this one, because the credits are fantastic with those outtakes that look like
I shot that.
On what, 16 or Super 8?
I shot it in black and white on reversal film.
Wow.
I took a camera with me to Finland, and some time off, there was some snow behind the stage. I was like, come on, guys, get out there and play. A rough house, I should say. Yeah.
Yeah, at 12, you have to roughhouse. At 6, you can play. At 12, you have to rush. those end credits with that footage is just fantastic. It is so, it's heartwarming and just filled with joy.
Thank you. I'm glad you stuck to the end.
Always. Always.
Yeah, right?
Always. May I be struck down by a lightning bolt if I ever do not watch a film through the bitter to the bitter end after the credits.
That's what you're here for. That's what you're
That's
what
it. Sinkei, yeah. I can't thank you enough. This has been so wonderful getting to speak with you.
Too, Debbie. Thank you.
And so in-depth about Last Ride. I can't wait to see what you bring us next, and I hope we get to chat again in the future.
I'm looking forward to that, too. Absolutely.
This has been just wonderful. So you go have a wonderful rest of your day.
And now, thank you so much.
And everybody else can sit back and watch Last Ride.
Yep. Check it out.
Thanks, Sinkei. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Debbie. Bye-bye.
And that was Sinkei Lee discussing Last Ride, which you can watch right now from the comfort of your own home on Prime Video, Apple TV, and other digital platforms. So you can get nice and cozy in your own house. You don't have to, you know, bear the cold, especially people back east who have just been undergoing horrific blizzards. It's a really good film. So I hope you check that one out. And that is all the time we have today. I told you we'd run long this week, and we did. But don't worry, I'll be back next week with more interviews and films to discuss. So until then, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.